Before we start, just a quick warning that this episode contains descriptions of violence or sexual content that may not be suitable for all listeners. The 53-year-old French King Louis VII sits in his audience hall with a smirk on his lips. Around him scurries the usual crowd of advisors, lawyers, and servants that populate the royal court. Musicians are tuning up instruments. Household flunkies clatter plates and drinking cups. You can also hear whispers of gossip around the room and hushed political bargains being struck. Today, Louis's court is even busier and noisier than usual. There's an excited buzz in the room. Gathered around him are some of the biggest big shots of the kingdom. Half a dozen mighty nobles, all of them with their own posse of counsellors and hangers-on. Many more knights and minor lords summoned from around the northern half of France. And then there are the guests of honour, three Plantagenet princes. The eldest sons of Louis's oldest rival and sparring partner, Henry II, King of England. There's Henry the Young King, 18 years old and recently crowned his father's co-monarch and heir in England, Normandy and Anjou. There's 15-year-old Richard, who's been in training to become Duke of Aquitaine. And Geoffrey, 14, who's being groomed to rule Brittany. All of them have decided they're fed up to the back teeth with their father, old Henry. All their lives, the guy has been a domineering, high-functioning control freak. He can't stop interfering in other people's business, and he doesn't trust anyone except himself to get things done. Of course, that's kind of why these lads are princes in the first place, each with their own fat chunk of French lands to rule, acquired for them by their father. But you know what teenagers are like. They've decided that they could do things better if only they were given a chance. So here they are, at the court of Dad's enemy, making plans to knock the old man off his perch. Suddenly, the hall falls quiet. And into it are announced two ambassadors sent from old Henry himself. An archbishop and a bishop. Faces the Plantagenet boys will have known well. Today, those faces are set firm and stern. The crowd parts and the bishops approach King Louis. Young Henry, Richard and Geoffrey can probably hear their hearts thumping in their ears. Louis doesn't break his sly grin, and very rudely he doesn't respond when the two senior churchmen offer him a formal greeting from their master, old Henry. Ignoring the insult and remaining calm, the bishops deliver their message. We know what they say thanks to an account written down a little while later by William of Newburgh. In peaceful terms, they demanded the return of the son, that's young Henry, and promised that if anything should appear to require amendment, it should be speedily rectified. This is pretty mild stuff. You can bet that the original message from the short-fused old Henry wasn't quite so polite. But Louis isn't interested. The account states that Louis asks, faux naively, who has sent him this message. "The King of England," they reply. "Ha!" laughs Louis. "This cannot be possible. Behold, the King of England is present here, and he sends no message to me through you. But even if you still call King the father, who was formerly King of England, know that he, as king, is dead. And though he may still act as king, this shall be speedily remedied, for he resigned his kingdom to his son, as all the world bears witness." If I may translate, Louis basically says, young Henry is the true King of England, and old Henry's time as king is as good as dead. I'm pretty sure you could have heard a pin drop around the court. There haven't been many times over the years when Louis has been able to get the better of old Henry, who, let's not forget, married Louis's ex-wife, seized control of about a third of France, and has repeatedly made a fool of him on the battlefield. But look who's laughing now. Louis sends the bishops scurrying back to their master with a message. The time for negotiation is over. From now on, I only recognise your sons as rulers. No more talking. England and France are once more plunged into war, and it will take a miracle to get them out of it. I'm Dan Jones, and from Something Else and Sony Music Entertainment, this is History, A Dynasty to Die For, Episode 12, The War Without Love. Spring is here, a time of rebirth and new beginnings, so it's the perfect excuse to give your mealtimes a makeover and expand your food horizons with Factor. Factor send you chef-crafted, ready-to-eat meals that take just 2 minutes to make. It completely takes the stress out of cooking to give you time to focus on your springtime goals. And if you're feeling fancy, maybe you want to feel a bit like a Plantagenet royal. They have gourmet options with premium ingredients. We're talking filet mignon, shrimp, broccolini, and asparagus and truffle butter. So actually, you'll eat way better than a medieval king, because truffle was banned at feasts, thanks to its sensual qualities. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/danjones50 and use code danjones50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code danjones50 at factormeals.com/danjones50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. We've spent the last two episodes looking at the family fallouts that lead to the war without love. How young Henry's teen angst and belief he was being overlooked sent him hurtling into a full meltdown, and how he was either persuasive enough, or his father was annoying enough, that his two brothers decided to join him. So did his mother, Eleanor, but Henry was quick enough to capture her before she made it. And as things start, it doesn't look good for dear old Dad. The coalition that assembles against King Henry II is properly daunting. Plenty of lords sign up to the rebellion because there are plenty of tempting reasons to join. There was the Becket scandal, the fact that Henry's own family were against him, and perhaps they were simply sick of the same jerk ruling them for 20 years. Plus, the rebels have a straightforward strategy. They'll raise hell all over the Plantagenet Empire, attacking royal strongholds from England to Aquitaine. But they'll concentrate most of their resources on running Henry out of Normandy, piling into it from every point on the compass. Hopefully, Henry will find himself fighting on far too many fronts at once and be unable to defend them all adequately, leaving Normandy to fall first. Why? Well, Normandy is the central hub of the Plantagenet lands. It connects the realm of England with everything else. It also has plenty of money there, and it's close to Louis's court in Paris. If Normandy falls, old Henry will end up either stuck in England or stuck south of the River Loire. His empire will be literally torn in half, and he'll be forced to negotiate. The probable end goal will be to strip away England for young Henry, Aquitaine for Richard, and Brittany for Geoffrey. Old Henry will be handed Normandy back, but only if he accepts that his ultimate lord is Louis. Can you imagine old Henry grovelling before Louis? No, I didn't think so. So that's the plan. Simple enough from a military standpoint. Of course, underlying it is some very dodgy forward thinking, particularly on the part of Henry the young king. Winning control of your future empire by starting a civil war and inviting all your neighbours to invade is a bit like evicting squatters from your house by setting fire to it. What's more, in order to lure allies like the Counts of Flanders and Boulogne and the King of Scotland into joining the coalition, young Henry promises them massive concessions of land and huge payments if he wins. So he's handing out big chunks of his prize before he's even won it. Excuse me if I point out here that the young king is not the sharpest crayon in the Plantagenet pencil case. His father, on the other hand, just happens to be the canniest and most determined politician and commander of his generation, an experienced wager of wars, and, as we know, unbelievably lucky. Once the war begins, in the late spring of 1173, all these things come to a head. it soon becomes obvious that no matter how big an alliance the rebels assemble, no matter how cunning their plan, and no matter how hostile their treatment of old Henry, he's a very hard man to get the better of. Henry decides to delegate. He doesn't try and lead every campaign of the war himself. The theatre of operations is just too vast. He relies on trusted deputies, pops up where he's needed, typically at just the right time, and waits for his enemies to make mistakes, which they do. His first victory comes in the high summer, when two major rebel leaders, the Counts of Flanders and Boulogne, who are brothers, invade northern Normandy, attacking the castle of Drancourt. After a siege, the castle surrenders, but at heavy cost. During the fighting, a crossbowman takes a pot shot at the Count of Boulogne and hits him in the leg, inflicting a very severe wound. It takes the Count several days to die, but die he does. And this has a major knock-on effect. Since he's his brother's heir to the County of Flanders, the other sibling has to retire from the war as well to sort out the hot mess this creates back home. One crossbow pot shot, two enemies out of action in a single day. Bring it on. Then there's a family reunion of sorts. After weeks of fighting, there's a face-off between Henry and Louis and all three Plantagenet princes. The lead rebels and their armies are approaching a town in Normandy called Verneuil. Losing it will be disastrous for Henry, so he ploughs money and men into its defences. He challenges his sons and Louis to settle things in a battle, you know, you, me, outside the castle, after school. And then, well, Louis and the Plantagenet princes bottle it. They don't have the same appetite for risk as old Henry. They manage to raid and burn the nearby town, but then their army abandons the fight. They're forced to flee too, leaving behind their weapons and supplies, which old Henry's army gratefully snatches for themselves. And old Henry's victories keep coming. In late August, he wins a storming triumph against rebels in Brittany after marching 200 miles in 2 days to attack. That's the equivalent of nearly 8 marathons back to back. In October, the Earl of Leicester, leading the rebel cause in England, is routed in a battle in Suffolk. The mercenaries in Leicester's army are butchered, and Leicester himself is taken prisoner and shipped off to jail in Normandy. Oh, and by the way, apparently Leicester's wife, Petronilla, takes part in this battle wearing male armour, female armour not being, you know, a thing. According to one writer from the time, she's bold enough to join the battle because she thinks the Englishmen in the Royalist army are better at boasting, drinking, and eating pies than they are at fighting. She's wrong. She's captured hiding in a ditch as she tries to escape the battlefield, but her story shows Eleanor of Aquitaine isn't the only woman determined to step outside the gender roles of her age. More on her and some other tales from the War Without Love in this week's subscriber episode. But back to our main story. When winter comes and the weather becomes too poor for fighting, a truce is agreed to last until the spring of 1174. Old Henry has far more reason to be pleased about this than his sons. He's proven himself over and over again to be in a different league to anyone else. The war is now his for the winning. He's captured or neutralised many rebel leaders, including Eleanor. Yet at the same time, he's not totally out of the woods. His sons are still estranged from him. They rejected what he considered to be a generous offer of peace that autumn. He offered them plenty of money, but they wanted real power. And there are many rebels still at large who suspect that the tide could still turn against old Henry. To finally win the war, he'll need something bigger than battlefield victories and hostages. He'll need a sign from God, a miracle. Of course, Henry being Henry, that's exactly what he gets. The world's full of people celebrating their successes, but if the Plantagenets have taught us anything, it's that failing is much more interesting. So that's why I'm certain you're going to love the podcast How to Fail. the very brilliant Elizabeth Day invites guests on to talk about three of their biggest failures and what they've taught them about life. It's a great way to hear a new side to people you may think you know. Guests include Bernie Sanders, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and Stanley Tucci. Give it a try. Find How to Fail wherever you get your podcasts. In March 1174, as soon as the official truce period ends, the war without love starts again, bloodier and nastier than ever. The year before, old Henry had proven himself unbreakable in Normandy and the rest of his French lands. Now the focus of the rebellion switches to England. The rebel plan is to hit it from two directions. Young Henry is preparing a mighty invasion force to arrive from the southeast. But first they hit the north, in an invasion led by the King of Scots, William the Lion, 32 years old and a bullish, ambitious king who came to the throne just over 8 years earlier. He doesn't have the military strength or know-how to break English castles, but he leads a terror campaign across the countryside, backed by Flemish mercenaries paid for by the young king. One grisly account states that you could have seen Flemings tying up peasants and leading them off roped together. Women flee to the church only to be snatched away naked, leaving behind their clothes and their valuables. They carry this on throughout the spring and early summer, despite fierce resistance led by one of old Henry's illegitimate sons, also called Geoffrey, a badass bishop who's much better at fighting than praying. All the while, the young king's invasion fleet is getting closer to being ready. Eventually, old Henry realises the only way to save England is to get over there himself. So, in early July, he slips out of Normandy by boat, bringing with him a small army of mercenaries, as well as his highest value prisoners, including Queen Eleanor and the Earl of Leicester, as well as young Henry's wife Margaret, whom he's been keeping hostage ever since the revolt began. As soon as he lands in England, he goes straight for the one place he reckons he can win the war without unsheathing a single sword or loosing a single arrow. Canterbury. Specifically, Canterbury Cathedral. He needs to speak to the person who started all his troubles in the first place. His old friend turned nemesis, Thomas Becket. On July the 12th, 1174, Henry arrives on the outskirts of Canterbury. He doesn't come as a king. Instead, he walks barefoot, wearing only a loose-hanging, rough wool shift. Over the uneven cobbles and hard-baked streets he walks, until he reaches the cathedral precinct. And there he goes to the shrine of Becket, now not only a dead archbishop, but a bona fide saint, canonised the previous year by the Pope. In front of Becket's tomb, Henry confesses to anyone who can hear him that the murder was his fault. Then he strips off his shirt, and the monks of the cathedral chapter beat him with sticks until the blood runs down his back. After that, he fasts all night, praying that God will have mercy on him and help him defeat his enemies. It's a sensational piece of propaganda, political theatre of the highest calibre. And even better, it works. The next morning, as Henry is finishing his vigil at Becket's tomb, William the Lion of Scotland is finishing up his breakfast near Alnwick Castle in Northumberland. The lion may well choke on his porridge as he sees an army bearing Henry II's banners coming over the horizon. He barely has time to organise his own troops before the attack begins. And in the short battle that ensues, William's horse is killed and falls down, trapping him under its body. Helpless, William is snatched from the battlefield and taken off to prison. Messengers are sent at top speed to London to track down Henry and tell him the astonishing news. Thomas Becket has answered his prayers. Yet another of the major players has been captured. The young king will never dare invade without the other half of his pincer movement in place. The revolt in England is over. After giving thanks to God, or should it have been the devil, Henry turns his mind to the end game of the Great Plantagenet War. That lies across the Channel, where King Louis of France, the three Plantagenet boys, and the few remaining allies are preparing to attack the Norman capital of Rouen. But we hardly need to guess how that goes. Henry has proven himself a match for everyone who's taken him on. Louis and young Henry lay siege to Rouen, but as soon as old Henry turns up, it's a repeat of their first face-off. Their army panics. Louis and young Henry run away. The game is up. Louis has bankrolled the rebellion, and he's wasted every penny. Henry's sons have gambled everything on it, and they've lost. There's nothing they can do but return to their father with their tails between their legs, hoping he'll forgive them. As for old Henry, he can name his terms. The only question is whether he's more keen on reconciliation or revenge. And that's what we'll be exploring next time on This Is History. As always, if you're craving more Plantagenet drama, I've got you. Join me on This Is History Plus, where every week I reveal the weird details, fun facts, and fascinating subplots we don't have time for in the main story. This time, we're going all in on the War Without Love, the Becket propaganda, Henry's master strategies, and other tales from the front lines we just didn't have time for. On top of that, as a subscriber, you'll get all our episodes ad-free. Just visit This Is History on Apple Podcasts and click Try Free at the top of the page to start your free trial today. Or visit thisishistorypod.com to get access wherever you get your podcasts. Finally, if you're enjoying the show, please leave us a rating or a review. We particularly love to see 5 stars.